Dob was asleep on the floor mattress in his tiny one-room apartment in Berlin when he was awakened by a loud snap, the sound of someone breaking down his door. He sprang up in his bed to see four pistols directed at his head. Behind each gun was an officer in civilian clothing. "What's going on?" Dob demanded. "Surrender your weapon," they ordered back, although there was no gun in sight. He was arrested at once. Marcus Hess had just settled into a comfortable exercise regimen. 5 mornings a week he arose at 6:45 to go for a swim before work. On March 2, 1989, he was just returning, refreshed and cheerful, his hand in his pocket, reaching for his keys to open the front door to his apartment, when he heard a quiet, polite voice at his back, the tone of someone who might be asking for directions. "Herr Hess?" He turned around to see 8 well-dressed men staring at him. He knew immediately what was happening, and although he wasn't surprised when they informed him at once that he was under suspicion of espionage, Hess began to pray. Upstairs in Hess's apartment were more officers. Hess insisted on calling his lawyer's office. When police had escorted Hess to his apartment in June 1987, his lawyer had been on the scene within a few minutes, and the lawyer's acumen had emboldened Hess to treat the situation with a cavalier attitude. But this time, the police were frighteningly well organized. When Hess called his lawyer's office, there was no answer. On his second attempt, he reached a secretary, who told him his lawyer would be out for most of the day. Hess had no choice but to let the search begin. After a thorough scouring of Hess's apartment, the officers took him for an interrogation at police headquarters in Hanover, where the authorities had rented out an entire floor of the building for the handling of the hacker spy case. It was Hess's first introduction to Eckhart Kohlhaas, the prosecutor in charge of the case. Marcus Hess's first impulse was to admit to hacking, and in particular to breaking into the computers at the Berkeley Laboratory. He admitted that he knew Hagbard and the others, and that he had given Hagbard 3 or 4 logins for the purpose of hacking. He even admitted to providing software to Dob and receiving money for it from Carl, and to giving software later to Carl directly, then getting money for it. But he denied any espionage activity and any knowledge of it. "I've never consciously worked for a hostile secret service," he declared in a carefully crafted phrase. Carl never said for what or for whom he needed the software, and I never asked. "Are you familiar with someone by the name of Sergei?"
"That name is unknown to me," Hess lied.
"Sergei is believed to be from the trade mission in East Berlin. Sergei is believed to be the one who ordered this software."
"I have absolutely no knowledge of this," Hess insisted.
But as the questions wore on, it became clear to Hess that someone in the group had been talking. The next question unhinged Hess completely. According to the information we have from the federal police, Sergei was mentioned openly in conversations among Brzezinski, Koch, Carl, Huebner, and you. Wherein the logins you procured were meant to go to Sergei. What do you say to that? There was no point in continuing to deny things. Everyone's name was out.
That's right, Hess replied. Those people did speak of Sergei, and it was clear to me that Sergei was in the East and he must belong to the Russian Secret Service.
Hess went on to explain that after he had heard the others talk of logins going to Sergei, he immediately went back to LBL and altered the passwords into the Berkeley computer. When his interrogators read him several lists, supplied by Hagbard, of dozens of systems for which Hess allegedly supplied logins, including a computer at the Anniston Army Depot, the Optimus database at the Pentagon, and several computers of the Environmental Protection Agency, Hess denied it. In fact, from what Hess could tell, Hagbard had been feeding the authorities a damning array of confused stories. He was telling of logins to computers that dated back to late 1985, when Hess and Hagbard had hacked together. But these logins, Hess tried to explain, had nothing to do with Sergei. The story that Hess told in those first few hours was the one he would stick with for the next year, even as the prosecutors built their own compelling case against him. By the time the 10-hour interrogation session had ended, Hess had confessed to delivering at least 6 programs to Carl with the full knowledge that the software was headed for the East. Mostly, he said, it was software he more or less chanced upon at Focus, but he insisted that he had never given computer logins and passwords to Hagbard to give to Peter Carl, and that not once had he given information from computers to Carl to sell to Sergei.
Hagbard, he claimed, had psychological problems, and that fact should be taken into account when weighing the credibility of anything Hagbard said. Unlike the search of the Focus offices in 1987, this time Hess sensed he would remain in custody. He spent the night in jail. The following morning, he was flown by helicopter to Karlsruhe for a deposition before a magistrate. It was an uncomfortable and awkward ride, as Hess and Kohlhaas were forced to sit side by side on a narrow seat. During the 30-minute trip, Kohlhaas sat silently and read through his papers. The two men didn't exchange a word. Because Marcus Hess, a young man with a clean record and stable job, presented no flight risk, he was freed later that afternoon. His first call was to his father, who drove to Karlsruhe to pick him up. Hess spent the weekend with his parents, an hour's drive from Karlsruhe, in Fulda. He had a lot of explaining to do, mostly as to why an otherwise perfectly well-adjusted son, the very picture of decency and conservative values, had engaged in such anomalous and unseemly behavior, placing his bright future in jeopardy, and all for the sake of 15,000 marks. Hess had always had a close and warm relationship with his parents, but he had never discussed his computer break-ins with them, not only because they were illegal, but also because his parents simply would not be able to understand his general obsession with computers. In the end, his parents made it clear that they would stand by him. Peter Carl had been arrested the previous morning as he was pulling out of a parking space near his Hanover apartment. He was just starting out on one of his car deliveries to Spain, and there was no telling if this was to be his permanent move there, so the police acted swiftly. Two unmarked cars blocked Carl as he began to drive away. One officer leapt out of his car and into Carl's. The arrest took approximately 30 seconds. For both Dobb and Carl, it became apparent after an hour or so of being questioned that Pengo and Hagbard had gone to the authorities. Eventually, both of them confessed to espionage, but they weren't to be accorded the same leniency that Marcus Hess got. Dobb and Peter Carl had previous arrests on their records, and both were considered flight risks. Carl for his plans to go to Spain, and Dobb for his avoidance of military duty. Both were taken into custody. Carl's ex-wife came forward to say she would take out a loan for 1,000 marks for bail, but Prosecutor Kohlhaas felt uneasy about setting Carl free and urged the judge to deny bail. Kohlhaas saw his case strengthen when, during the search for Carl's apartment, a Casio pocket calculator was found. It contained the telephone number for one Sergei Markov.